Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on The Mark Steiner Show, your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. On our way to this conversation, I'm going to give you like a news update here. There is an active shooter on Ohio State University's campus. There have been at least 8 people shot, and we will keep you abreast of that as the news breaks, and we continue getting these updates. We'll let you know what's going on. If there is a number here, if we get it, we'll give it to you in case you have family members on that campus. We'll try to get you places you can make that information and make that call to see what's going on. We're turning our attention in this hour to our local politics, our local world here of Baltimore. We're joined by Dana Peterson Moore, community activist, member of the Baltimore City Liquor Board, former chair of the City Ethics Board, and an attorney here in the city. Dana, good to see you. Welcome to the studio. It's
good to be back. Thank you.
Brandon Soderberg joins us once again, this time not to talk about the city paper, but maybe in a sense, deputy editor and arts editor of the Baltimore City Paper. Brandon, good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk at steinershow.org. By email, you can tweet us at Mark Stein or log on to our Facebook pages. But do call in your thoughts of what's going on around our town, 410-319-8888. A week from tomorrow, we will have a new mayor, 8 new city council people. And Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake has made her comments that she's thinks she's accomplished a great deal in her term as mayor, even though she realizes how far we have to go given what happened around Freddie Gray. What are your thoughts?
Well, they're looking at me. The rodeo doesn't show.
I was looking both ways. See who wants to go first.
I can go.
Well, you know, I'll start. I think she's right. The city, ours is a city that's constantly evolving, changing and growing. There is a lot more to do. But if you drive around Baltimore, you'll see a lot of positive growth, a lot of improvements. I know in my own neighborhood, which is Charles Village, we've seen a lot of changes. There's a lot more housing, but we still have issues about access to housing. We still have issues about abandoned housing. And that's the part of where there's a lot more to do. Stephanie is a quiet leader. And I think a lot of times her leadership style was misunderstood. She was sort of, to me, was sort of like a duck on water, appeared to be gliding smoothly, but there was a lot of activity going on beneath the surface. Huh. And people will realize that soon enough.
Brandon, your take.
It's tough for me not to think of the many problems with the mayor immediately, and I think
which is why I jumped in and started.
Well, yeah, that's good. Let's start there. Yeah, I mean, I was especially reflecting on where the mayor was at the beginning of the term and now, and I feel like so much of the mayor's attitude, which I worry will continue with Pew as well, is this PR oriented mayorship in which,
what do you mean by that?
How things look becomes more important than what's done. I'm not dismissing anything she's done, but I feel like there's a real courting of tourists in the county, and I think her handling of the uprising in particular was really frustrating for how it seems so concerned with how the outside looked at it. I've not lived in a city where I've seen a mayor so focused on the people in the county or the people that are watching, looking in on us, and I find that element of her, how she ran the city, really frustrating. And then maybe because I'm a reporter, I was very frustrated with the recent banning of WYPR reporter, which I think symbolizes it's symbolic. Like, it's not reporters aren't that kind of story isn't a big deal, but it seems, again, a focus on PR and a focus on controlling the narrative constantly and coming up against any pushback and sort of becoming very frustrated. One of the things I think about a lot was attending a lot of the public safety meetings following the uprising, and the rub at the time was between concerns about police violence and also workaday concerns for so many people who were basically like, I'd like to be able to leave my house and not worry about, you know, getting robbed or hit in the head with a pipe. And to all of those things, the mayor's response was so often, you know, we're working on it, it doesn't happen overnight, which is very true. But at some point, that becomes a sort of weird, frustrating mantra to hear a lot. And I think that's what I hear a lot, is oh, we're still working on it, we'll get to it, you know, we can't do it overnight, which I don't think anyone expects us to do it overnight. It seems a little bit like passing the buck a little bit.
So one of the things I've done over the last, I guess, 4 or 5 years since I started my own law firm is whenever I had an opportunity to work in public service, I've taken that opportunity. So over the last, I guess, 3 years, I've served on the liquor board, which I know you know, and you know, and I also worked on the planning commission. And years ago, I was an attorney for the housing authority in private practice. And I'll just say this: when people say that they're working on it, typically they say that because they really, really are. And government processes are slow. It's rare that we get to just make a decision and then make it happen. And I feel that especially now on the liquor board. We will come up with ideas that will absolutely improve the quality of life, but then getting everything lined up, it's like sun, moon, stars, and it really is hard. In terms of public safety, that seems to be one of the biggest issues that cities and people all across the country are dealing with. And I'm not an apologist for anybody, not at all, but I live in Charles Village. I cross 33rd and Greenmount every single day, probably 3 or 4 times a day, if not more. I've gotten to know we have our homeless people. We have our homeless persons that I recognize. And then you actually, it's weird, you start to miss them if you don't see them. We have our community police officers that we know. When things go wrong, or maybe things go right and there's someone gets hurt, it's really difficult when the community's first response is to lay blame and fault that the police have misacted. So for all of the strides that are being made in terms of public safety in the police department, one incident has the potential to wipe out all that good.
So folks, do give us a call, 410-319-8888, as we wind down with Stephanie Rawlings-Blake's administration. State Senator Catherine Pugh about to become mayor of Baltimore, 8 new city council members, what changes that might make or not. And speaking of public, so 410-319-8888, tweet us at Mark Steiner. Write us an email to us at talkatsteinershow.org, 410-319-8888. But talking about that, there was a shooting by police officers of a man wielding a knife on Greenmount and 33rd.
Police say he was wielding a knife. We don't know yet.
Yeah, let me pick that up.
Yeah, sorry, I feel like cranked today. Yes, so Friday morning, I guess around 9 a.m., police say that a man was holding two knives and was kind of dancing on 33rd and Greenmount. They asked him to put the knives down. I'm all repeating what the commissioner said at the press conference.
Yeah.
I also live in Charlesville, so I would run over there and see it, see the press conference, that sort of thing. So the commissioner said that they then tried to deploy tasers, which they said didn't take effect. I'm not sure what that means exactly. So then they felt that they needed to shoot him. They say he was armed with two knives. Other people there seem to say one knife. I was talking to residents there. Either way, he seemed to be armed with something. That's what everyone agrees with. And then there was that. So that happened on Friday morning, and by, I guess, 11:30, there seemed to be a group of people gathering. That's what I saw when I was over there. And you just saw what you sort of address, which is this, for better or worse, this very quick, almost knee-jerk reaction to distrusting what the story you heard people saying. Everyone was saying, don't shoot him. Other people said they see him around. And again, I know what you mean about you see there are homeless people around. People, you try to grab their phone and let them charge your phone in your house for 20 minutes, something like that. But there was a lot of frustration from that and the story. So you sort of had this trust and tension that we see every time these police shootings happen bubble up immediately and sort of start to fly over the yellow tape. A lot of accusations and that sort of thing. And we still don't know too much about the shooting. They released the police officers' names on Saturday evening.
You're right, I saw that, yeah.
But we still haven't seen the body camera footage. I assume they're going to release that soon after the names, but they didn't. But that also may be because of another thing that happened on 33 and Greenmount, which maybe we'll get to in a moment.
Which is what?
The death of the baby who died.
One of the women who was demonstrating, her child...
Yes.
Died while it was inside in a restaurant waiting for her.
Yeah.
So holding
yeah.
The baby
sorry. Yeah. I can quickly explain. I was also at that, but I didn't really get a chance to speak. I'm sorry. So
that's okay.
Real quick, and then maybe we can jump back. Would be
sure,
that.
Sure.
Yeah. Sorry. There was a gathering around 2 p.m. on Saturday, the day after the police shooting, about 20 activists, and towards the end of it, one of the activists took their baby into the pizza places on the corner there. And then it wasn't breathing. I believe it had blood coming out of its nose. And a police officer came over who was watching the protest. And he came into the pizza place, performed CPR on the child. Then EMTs came. But what the police said was that the baby died either when it, on the way to the hospital or at the hospital. I also saw that, and it was like the most heroic thing I've ever seen, maybe in my entire life, by Major Gibson from the police and everybody involved. But I'm not sure, but the sort of concurrently was the releasing of the police officers' names. So maybe that's why the body camera footage hasn't been put out. But there's sort of a concern about that. And Davis kind of, I think, Commissioner Davis had said that he was going to put out the camera footage. He kind of half promised that. So we're still waiting on that as well.
So, I'm sure that the body camera footage will be released. But I mean, if you put all of these things together, and you said you live in Charles Village, the owner of, I mean, the restaurant was Mama Lucia's, which is it's my husband has gone there for years. And they know him as Mr. Wednesday because he used to take our daughters there for pizza night. And we eat there often enough. So this is all very local. It's all very neighborhood-based. We know, you know, the people that are involved. Officer Gibson is sort of our community guy. You can't find a nicer person. If you go out and look, you'll find YouTube footage of him dancing.
I would just interrupt and say he's a great guy. He's a really solid dude.
he really is. And so on that, we completely agree. And he sort of is an angel, probably will be viewed as an angel to try
he's
to save this child.
He's the one who helped resuscitate the baby.
He tried to resuscitate the baby.
He was sort of the
baby.
First on the scene and really right. acted heroically.
And there's different news on the age of the child. I heard 2 weeks old. I heard 2 months old. I heard 1 month old. So I don't know the age of the baby. But I did try to reach the owner of Mama Lucia's just to get his firsthand assessment, and he's just not available. He's just not talking. But this is tragic all around. Someone who we probably know, probably someone we've laid eyes on many, 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 many times, had a bad day, got out of hand, and was shot. We grieve that.
I mean, it does. I'm going to open the phone to you. I mean, that what happened, I don't know any of the facts or details other than what you have said, Brandon, with red.
And I'm just repeating with, I did not see the shooting, so I'm just saying what the police said.
And I have not talked to anybody who has seen the shooting either, who from the community at all. But, you know, I keep seeing this video in my head that I can share and maybe on Facebook later of the British police. And there's this man on the corner in the front of his house, middle of a block, waving these huge axes. And the police trying to corner him to stop him. He was white, British, and the police officers surrounded him, and they went back and forth and tried to stop him and just kind of tried to corner him in, and then they called for reinforcements, and officers came in with shields, and they moved in on this man with their shields as he was wielding an axe on the shields, and then surrounded him, forced him to the ground, picked him up, handcuffed him, and took him to a mental institution for evaluation. Every time I see that video, I think about things like this and whether there are different ways for us. Granted, when you're confronted with somebody with a knife, it's a frightening situation no matter who you are. But if there are other ways for us to begin to think of how we can address these things in our communities rather than with deadly force all the time.
We have to.
The way we have to respond to somebody. Clearly, you must have been mentally disabled, maybe homeless, and you know, could have been off his meds for that moment.
Most likely.
We don't know anything. I'm not making suppositions here. We don't know anything.
Right. I mean, we would hope that that there was a different way to respond. And if I could just back it up a little bit, wouldn't it be wonderful if we didn't have homeless people on the street that are seriously in need of some medical attention and not getting it? And I put it on Facebook. Last week, my granddaughter and I were going into Starbucks, and we see a fully engulfed fire at the Village Lofts next door that had been set by a homeless person. And, you know, it turns out he wanted to be arrested so that he could get off the street and into jail to get medical care. I think if you unpack these situations and get to the root, there are people that are crying. They need help and they're not getting it. And as a society, we're just watching. We're not acting. I think that's a shame. That's on us.
So on the way to the phone, Ben, you want to add anything before we hit the phones?
Real quick, I feel like this show is the hyper-local Charles Village news today, but I'll real quick
feel like that.
But that's cool. But real quick, I would just say that I hear you and I agree with you. We need to help people who need help more. But I would also say that a concern I have is, so for example, I have sort of my homeless dude on the corner that I'll talk to and chat with. Sometimes he's a little out of control. Sometimes he pees right in the street. It's all good. He's got to do what he's got to do. And some days he's hurting a lot. He seems really worried. And there's some days where I'm sometimes worried about other people's safety, but I am always worried about who do I call if he gets too out of control. I don't want to, I worry about calling the police and what happens to that man. And I worry about, you know, the police will show up. And that's sort of, I think, something that was also framed with this, the guy who was shot. There's this binary between mental health and criminal. And those things are blurry sometimes.
Right.
And I think that sort of the comments by Davis to sort of just lean this man to, he was a threat, which he was. If he had knives, he was absolutely a threat, especially on Greenmount at 9 in the morning on a Friday, after the holidays especially. But I think that we need to, the police sometimes don't understand that it's not a binary. You're not either mentally unstable or a criminal, or there. It moves back and forth. It's complicated sometimes. And I don't know where this... I think that there was I worry in the way that the commissioner was speaking about it, that he was concerned primarily with people's safety, which I understand, but it just seems like I wish that there was someone else to call that could come there other than the police, or that the police won't come second right there.
Well,
you know?
I think that's part of the discussion that we've been trying to have on this program, which is are there alternative ways we can think of public safety other than just the police always being those first responders in those situations? I mean, That's something we really need to talk about as a community. Let me open the phones unless you want to jump in really quick.
Well, I just want to say sometimes the first responders are us. You know, I don't know what I would do if I saw someone with a knife, wielding a knife.
I'd probably try to get out of the way.
Well, the first thing you do is try to get out of the way. I probably would call 911 and say, look, this is a real public safety issue, and help is needed. If my daughter and granddaughter walk past there often, I would be horrified if they were stabbed or hurt, and no police intervention. So you got to look at it from so many different perspectives, and you know, in the moment, I don't say that shooting was the right answer, but stopping him and stopping that whole wielding of a knife or knives had to end.
And I think that maybe the question is, are there other ways to handle this rather than shooting? But let's go
okay.
I mean, which is a really difficult thing to answer.
Yeah.
Let me go to tweets first, and then we'll go right to the phones. Let's see. We have a tweet in here, and Matthew Ekin tweeted after we talked about what we thought of Stephanie Williams Blake. She accomplished what they say we should fear Donald Trump might provide. Was a comment on?
Oh, I wish he could have a little more digits on that.
Yeah. Well, maybe you can retweet more ideas if you please do it. Please do 410-319-8888 or tweet us at Mark Steiner. Chris, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Mark, and to you again.
Good morning, Chris.
If I could, you guys touched on a few things, but the one thing that really stood out to me was the remark that sometimes government moves slowly, or often government moves slowly. Paraphrase. And respectfully, I think that's really a cop-out. I think it's about political will and what's important, the priorities of government. And so even after the uprising, or however people want to refer to them, the areas that complained about a dynamic are the least to see the dynamic change. We're seeing all type exponential growth across the city, as was stated. But is any of that in Sandtown? How much of that is in Berea or these different communities that experience so many issues that people have been speaking about for so long, but they're seeing so little change. Even in whether it's the area of economics, whether it's education, however we look at it, the change seems to be coming to the areas that were already kind of okay, if not better off. We're talking about, and again, I don't personally attack the mayor. I really stay away from that kind of thing. But I think as a function of the role that she served, I wasn't really happy with her tenure. There were good things that she did. I acknowledge that. But this is the same person who made statements towards people, if you're not happy with the city, you should go live on a farm. Kind of the attitude that was displayed prior to the uprising. Again, the growth in the areas that really need it, in whatever area you would assess, I think is still lacking.
Yeah, I know. And just to add to that, maybe a bit of a quip, and maybe it's unfair, but I'll throw it out here anyway. We seem to have a breed of people who run for mayor in Baltimore, become mayors, who are very thin-skinned.
Absolutely.
a lot of deeply defensive.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Whether it's William Donald Schaefer or Martin O'Malley or Stephen Rawlings Blake, and we'll see with the incoming mayor, but very thin-skinned.
Well,
which is tough to have when you're in politics. I mean,
I will tell you, it's really, really hard. City Paper did their best of, and when they talked about the liquor board, they said that we got the best musical chairs award. I thought that was hilarious.
I appreciate you getting it.
You all were like, I was like, well, pardon me. I mean, so I'm back. But we were going to do something really quippy in response, like a letter to the editor. We were really just too busy. We couldn't get to it.
We should still do that. It'd be great.
We'll do it. It's coming. But it's so hard because every day so there's something new where people tell you that, you know, you're no good, you're horrible, you're terrible. And at the same time, you're trying to get all these things done. I will say a lot of the changes that I talked about have been in the works for 4, 5, 6 years. And we're seeing the fruits of those just driving down Greenmount. The changes there were planned for many, many years. And I agree, Sandtown and West Baltimore need a lot more attention. I know that a lot of money was raised and a lot of money has been committed. The changes are coming. I haven't seen them yet.
But what changes? The question is, I mean, if you look at our poorest neighborhoods in Baltimore, poorest working class neighborhoods in the city, people can imagine changes are coming, but where are they? Right. We've been talking about changes for a long time.
I mean, Paul Graziano still has a job. That's to me is massive about the mayor and her priorities or her concerns. That guy still has a job.
Through 3 mayors.
Yes. And I believe what I've gathered is that there was often conversation that Graziano, you hear this or that, maybe it's been written somewhere, I can't recall, that the mayor was interested in getting rid of him early on. You couldn't have any more reason to get rid of this guy. I mean, she just appeared with him in Park Heights. What was that, a week or two ago? Because they're, that again, sort of a PR stunt showing up. We're going to gentrify this neighborhood. We're going to, Park Heights will be better, We'll bring in the millennials, which always, and that's another thing about this terminology. I'm just ranting, but what is millennials like my colleague Baynard Woods has pointed out, like Freddie Gray was a millennial too, but that's not what our mayor means
right.
by millennial.
Right.
But Paul Graziano should not have a job anymore, and he has a job, and that makes it hard to take the mayor seriously.
When we in America talk about the working class, we talk about white people. Finding that most of black folks and other folks in America are working class. We talk about millennials, we talk about white people.
Yeah, the white leisure class, absolutely.
Right. We're not talking about black millennials, especially black working class millennials in this town. These are like little operative catchphrases we use that we know the meaning, right? And we look at Park Heights and these development ideas. Again, here's what I'm talking about. What has really changed, and will Catherine Pugh change this dynamic? We're talking about redeveloping Park Heights, but are we talking about redeveloping Park Heights for the people who live in Park Heights, or are we talking about redeveloping Park Heights for new, quote-unquote, millennials
right.
to move in so they can get to the train station more quickly? I mean, that's to get to their jobs in Washington, or whatever that is. I mean, so that to me is the battle began over Port Covington. That was pushed to do things they didn't want to do in the beginning because of the public outcry and what happened, though I think many people think didn't go far enough. So how does that dynamic change? Is that a question of take time, or is it a question of not even going in the right direction to get there in time, or whatever time that is?
I think time is up. I think that so much work has been done already that people are expecting to see the fruits of all that labor now. I think Catherine Pugh is coming in at a time where people are focused, they're engaged, they know how to demand change, they want it, it's been promised. I think that, everything that I've heard from Catherine Pugh is that she's ready to work. She's ready to make changes. And I mean, what is wrong with change being for black and white? Not just the black millennials, but the white millennials. I mean,
because the change in Baltimore seems to not be for black millennials and working class kids. It's always for everybody else.
Well, what I'm saying is it's got to be for both.
Right.
It has to be for both. If you want success, it has to be for black and white. And, you know, we all, you know, I hear it. I'm African-American. I hear what I think are dog whistles. But it's not acceptable.
We have to take a very short break. I'm right back to Brandon as well. Soderbergh is with us in the studio. Donna, we're going to come right back to your call. You're the first caller up. Ernest, you're the next caller up. We're going to get to both your calls. And let me read this tweet on the way out to think about this. We can come back and talk about it. Santa Cruz 12th man tweeted in, "Worst mayor ever, and I've lived in New York City. She closed fire companies and gave people room to destroy B-more." We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. Good to have you with us here on The Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. You can join Dana Peterson-Moore, community activist, member of our city's liquor board, former chair of the ethics board in the city here, as well as being an attorney at law and private practice, Brandon Soderbergh, who is deputy editor and art editor of the Baltimore City Paper, and you all at 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Send us an email to talk@steinershow.org or go on to our Facebook page, 410-319-8888. Let's go right to the phones. And Donna, you're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for holding.
Welcome. How you doing, Mark?
I'm very well.
An excellent guest you have on one show.
Thank you.
I heard so much being talked about, but we always forget the children. There's been an upsurge of child violence, you know, between, I say, 9 and 16, where kids want the same things that the working class and the millennials, the working class people have, but when they can't get it because they're poor and they're not getting it from the parents that, you know, if they're on welfare or government assistance, they reach out and start attacking or going up into the communities to get what they want. We really need to focus our attention, and I doubt that the next mayor is going to do it, but we need to focus our attention on what we're going to do to make sure that the children who are born into poverty get the care and the money that they were, you know, that's rightfully theirs when it comes to, you know, achieving better life than they have now when it goes through the mother. A lot of times, the mothers don't give, the money doesn't trickle down to the children, so the children act out. And the reason why I'm saying this, and I'll hang up, is there's been an upsurge of crime in Mount Vernon, Bolton Hill, and the Seton Hill area from public housing, from the young people, because they're saying, we don't have anything, so we have to go steal it. So this is a discussion. We need to talk about children going into poverty. If we don't start taking care of that population, making sure that they get the clothes and the food, because they're still not getting fed, you know, get the things that they need to survive, you know, beyond what their moms or their dads or their family are giving them, we won't be seeing the shootings or this mental health issue. But we have to work on the children because they're going to be our next future. And I wanted your guests to talk about that. I'll hang up. Thank you.
Donna, thanks so much.
Well, has anyone ever asked why there are so many children living in poverty in Baltimore? The answer is because their parents are living in poverty. I agree with some of what Donna said, that we need to take care of the children. We need to make sure they have what they need. I know that Baltimore has a lot of supportive services. We just passed some legislation that essentially is a promise from Baltimore that a certain percentage of the budget, of the city's budget, will go towards children. Catherine Pugh is coming in. She'll be the first mayor to actually exercise that budgeting authority along with the city council president, Jack Young. Expectations are very, very, very high, rightfully, that we will see a change in what happens with our children. I know that there are a lot of good people out here in the city that are doing what I would say is God's work, but obviously more is needed.
I mean, I think this is an issue that that the mayors have to grapple with, and nobody else can, especially even in the age of Trump, that we have to, pardon me if I'm sniffling, we have to come up with we have to come up with solutions in the city that make up for drastic changes. I'm not sure that we are prepared, capable, or ready to do that, Brandon.
Yeah, and in addition to that, I think that we vilify the poor, and we especially vilify the youth in this city. There's so many ways in which we... one example that's one of my many things I care a whole lot about is the dirt bike community, which is consistently vilified and criminalized. We should give them a park. We should have already done it. That's just one example of how we find these scapegoats, and it's especially grotesque that the city is often vilifying and criminalizing teens, people under 18 years old. It's a really, and that's obviously it's an extension of this not giving them the needs they need, not providing rec centers, all of these things. I'm not saying it's an easy fix, but the symptoms are clear. And I sometimes worry that the symptoms aren't known by, for example, the mayor in some ways.
And I think it's not an easy fix because the answers that may be given, the solutions that may be possible, are difficult to do. If you have a city with a limited budget, that means you have to take money from somewhere to make something happen. Or figure out other ways to do it. It means, we posited this, and I would, what it would be great to see a mayor say, we're going to investigate we're going to have a study done to see what it would mean if we took $100 million from the police budget and put it somewhere else. What effect that would have on the city? What effect would that have on the police? Mm-hmm. Really analyze that. I mean, I've called for that for a while, but let's analyze it. What would that look like? What would it mean? Mm-hmm. Would it be a good thing or a bad thing for the safety of the city and for the welfare of the people in this city? Mm-hmm. I think that's something we need to explore in a very serious way if we're going to be serious about what we mean by public safety and the health and welfare of our citizens.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, the police keep getting more money and they keep getting more tools. We have a spy plane that was spying on people in the summer, which the mayor had absolutely no real comment on, by the way, just to keep dinging the mayor here. But the police keep getting more tools. They keep getting more things to stop crime, and it doesn't seem to be working. I'm not trying to necessarily say that they are not totally working, but clearly, I think we all know, at least in theory, that the way you fix these problems is not by just giving the police more tools, but by focusing on the actual people and why they're committing crimes. And we're not doing that. And taking money away from the police would help do it. Right. Give it somewhere else.
Well, I agree. You've got to get to the root cause of the problem, and heard people say we need to have a children's commission that really looks at all of the things that impact our children, our neediest children, and start to really address the problems. School buildings, that's great, but at the end of, before they get to school and afterwards, what are we doing for our kids?
But the danger with a commission, and I'm going to open the phones here, and I remember Sheila Dixon got really upset with me on the show when I talked about this because the homeless commission started under her office. But what did it do over these last 8 years or 9 years, 10 years of this homeless commission? What has it done?
And some commissions act, Mark. Not all commissions.
Most commissions meet and talk, and very little comes out of those commissions.
A commission that's actually empowered to do something.
If the well-meaning elite of Baltimore gather together to talk about the problems, well, what do they come up with? Ever. That's the problem with
We have a lot of think tanks in this city, and everything operates as a think tank, and it can make you want to throw a chair across the room sometimes.
Yeah,
Mark.
It's that. That's...
Okay, so we don't have a children's commission. I take it back.
No, it was
a bad idea.
But I think that.
It's not necessarily. But
and also that. So you have a. Go for the children's commission. Let's do it. But the thing is, then it becomes we have a children's commission. So it's like that's the Band-Aid, and then we're supposed to shut up.
Of a commission as just a place for people to sit around and think. We do that in our all the time. Yeah. I was thinking of a commission that would actually do something and make sure that the services were happening. Make sure that there were. Active rec centers that were appealing and that kids actually wanted to go to and that there were services there. But
let's see what our listeners are thinking. 410-319-8888. We have two callers waiting here right now, Ernest and Herman. We're going to go to Ernest and Herman. Ernest, you're on the air. Welcome. Hi, Ernest, you there?
Yes. Hello? Well,
yes, you're on the air.
These police shootings is very troubling when you realize that some people are shot, some people are not shot. The lieutenant that was shot through the door with a shotgun by a white male at shift change. That male was not shot. That lieutenant was killed. They had holdups at the bank on Park Heights Avenue where an individual was shot and was caught with a gun. The police gave him an order to drop the gun. He was not shot. He dropped the gun. they had a shootout down at Mondawmin where a off-duty police had his gun taken and people were shot. When you were down in the basement, the individual gave him an order to drop his gun. He dropped his gun. He was not shot. You know, but when you have police commissioners as spokespersons, before an investigation is even conducted as to why, before a drug test was given or alcohol test was given, to try to justify these shootings on the airways before an investigation, this is what happens. And the police department goes the way as the police commissioner. If he justifies everything, then they're going to continue to do that. Thank God we have Marilyn Mosley, who is on her job and is not going to tolerate most cases. But, you know, they had, when I was on the force, they had Cruising Patrol 10 and Cruising Patrol 11, two big trucks that had everything on it. And when they had a person with a knife, they would come out and they would shoot a net around the individual. And that's what allowed the police to get control.
When did that happen, Ernest?
Huh?
When did that happen?
This happened before the 90s, between the 60s and the 90s. That's when I retired. But they had a Cruise Patrol 11 and Cruise Patrol 12. They had every kind of weapon on it that was the name. When you called them out for a mental case or something like that, a person you couldn't, they would shoot a net over the person. And that would allow you to lock the person up and to take him to a hospital where he could be examined by two doctors. In most cases, the person had a mental problem or something like that. I mean, they have to get a handle on this. But now that we have Donald Trump as the president and Jeff Beauregard Sessions, this is going to continue on and nothing is going to be done about it.
You raised some really important points, Ernest. I appreciate the call. Before we go to our next caller, let's wrestle with this for just a moment. I mean, I think that Ernest raised a number of issues. A, tactics, which is what I tried to talk about earlier with a British video of the police in London, or what Ernest is talking about, using a net as opposed to shooting somebody with deadly force to subdue somebody. Other ways of subduing somebody who's clearly mentally ill and has knives. We don't know if he's mentally ill, but my assumption is, given all the reports I've heard from people, that he must have been mentally ill. We don't know yet. But there's that. And then what he concluded with, I think there's something very real here. We have a consent decree that may mean nothing because of this new administration, federal administration coming in. It hasn't been signed yet by this mayor. So it's not going into effect until it's signed. And if that's belabored end of January, then it may never get signed with the new president. You have Trump and the new potential attorney general who could kind of really change the nature of policing by their embracing of hardcore policing. I mean, I think, you know, Brandon, this is a very real thing. This could be a dynamic change.
Right.
Tuesday night at City Hall, there was a public hearing tied to the consent decree, community policing ideas, also the surveillance plane. I attended it. And the specter of Trump was huge at that meeting on both sides. It was, in a way, it made me feel less doomed about everything because sort of everyone in the room, councilmen, police officers, activists, all were worried about Trump. It came up particularly in two different ways. It came up when there was these concerns about the surveillance plane in which ACLU's David Rocha invoked at me.
Right.
Like, even if you like the commissioner and you trust the commissioner, use this information, someone else will be commissioner later. And he said a good example of that is like, do you want Donald Trump to have information, access to this? And he would have access to this. The other way it came up was in terms of the consent decree, which everyone was sort of pushing that the consent decree feels particularly urgent because of this reason. And Councilman Brandon Scott had a particularly great line, which he pointed out that he doesn't know what a future looks like when there's an eternal attorney general who would call him boy to his face. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a very powerful line. Mm-hmm. So these, and that was the concern. And then I think the Trump presidency is terrifying on so many levels, but this is just one in which he's clearly emboldening.
The Jeff Sessions piece is very scary,
yeah.
Given who he is and what he stands for and how deeply racist he is.
And he's made it very clear who he is. And I've said it before, that when people tell you who they are, believe them the first time. And it's a real concern. I doubt that we're going to get a consent decree signed before January 20. We need to, in the most urgent way. It needs to be made a priority.
That would be one of the first questions I would ask Mayor Pugh once she becomes mayor. If it has been signed by December the 6th, are you going to sign it?
Right. Well, but what is it? I mean, is there actually a consent decree? Is there a document that's ready to be signed? Is there a document?
Is there not one?
There was an agreement to agree to a consent decree. But I don't know that the consent decree that would actually determine how our police department is going to function as it relates to society has actually been crafted.
I mean, from what I gather, it's in negotiations. And so we're in that, which, you know, and to make something that Commissioner Davis did point out, is the Ferguson consent decree took 13 months mm-hmm. to negotiate. Mm-hmm. The Seattle consent decree took 7 months to negotiate. There's a bunch more he named.
Right.
I just had those two
right.
written down, so I recall that information. So that was sort of the explanation. Now I'm going to tangent for a second and say that, like, this same meeting is about how we push through an illegal surveillance plane without consenting anybody. So
right.
we can push that through because public safety. We can't push a consent decree through because we might have we have an open fascist as a president as of January. That seems a little troubling to me. But
right.
there is that point that, like, these consent decrees have in the past always historically taken a while to negotiate.
Right.
I just think
that we're on the same page. I mean, we're at a point now where you can't worry about every single little fine detail. We need to have the broad terms agreed to and signed off on.
410-319-8888. Herman, line one, you're on the air. Welcome.
Howdy.
Morning, Herman.
I was at the Dana. I was at the liquor board hearing a couple weeks ago.
Hi, Herman. How are you?
I'm fine, and you?
Good.
Complaining about all the black plastic bags that are blowing around in our streets that originate in the liquor outlets, and I presented the liquor board, and including Dana, with a little sign I composed that to be placed in the window of each liquor carryout across the city. And I'm asking Dana, who liked the sign and liked the way it read, what's happening with it?
Well, I'll tell you what we did. Even before we left the hearing room, we all looked at it and we all agreed that we really, really, really like it. One of the things that we thought about was, and this is where government can kind of move slow, but then it can move fast. We thought of asking the liquor distributors to produce it and to make sure that it gets delivered with every liquor delivery. So each time they deliver bottles or beer or whatever, that they also deliver the signs and make sure that they're in the windows.
What do the signs say?
It basically says, Herman, I don't have it in front of me, but the language was essentially saying don't litter. The bags that liquor is put into when people, after they've made their purchase, don't just leave the bag on the street. You know, pick it up, put it in the trash. We love the idea, Herman. Thank you.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Join the conversation. And Mike, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Mike.
I'm an ex-police officer. I'm a retired correctional officer. I'm commenting on the comment that the guy made about the net.
Okay.
That's a good idea. As a correctional officer, we didn't have the luxury of carrying handguns inside the jail. When we encountered someone with a knife, we disarmed that person.
How did you do that?
We were taught how to do that. You know, you don't go it alone. There's more than one officer there. Also, we use shields. You know, why, you mean to tell me a police officer has a car, has a trunk? What's in the trunk? Why couldn't a shield and a helmet be in the trunk? So unless, when they get a call of a person with a knife, when they get to the scene, unless the person is actively attacking the public, then they have time to get this person under control physically. You know, the handgun is always the last resort. If a person comes at you hand-on-hand, you use your aspirin or your taser. It's always progressive. It's always escalated as far as weapons.
Right.
You know. So the handgun is the last resort, not the first.
So, Mike, let me ask you this question. As a former police officer, I'm glad you called in, a former corrections officer. So what do you think things have changed markedly in terms of policing and how we police? I mean, there's all been questions of in the black community, especially of police brutality from the Vini brothers on out and even before. But so what do you think has changed?
What has changed is the police officers are becoming too trigger happy. Okay, yeah, you want to go home. Everybody wants to go home after their shift, you know. But policing is policing. You're a peace officer first. You know, it's ways to de-escalate a situation. There's ways to do that. And like I said, the handgun is the last resort. If a person's armed with a handgun, yeah. If he won't drop it, he's not shooting at anyone, you're behind cover, you have time to talk to this guy to get him to drop the gun. Now, if he raises it in your direction, yeah, you have to do what you have to do. But you have time, and this has happened over the years. You know, only recently have police officers been shooting people like this, and also because of phone cameras that's capturing right. A lot of this. You know, officers know who the trigger happy officers are. They know who they are. They know that the prejudice officers out there who on a nice calm Sunday evening is stopping checking people, black people in a black neighborhood for no apparent reason at all. They know who these officers are.
Mike, what you're saying is really important. I think, you know, we have. And I know from my own life experience and from listening to people around me now that people can look at the police as the problem, right?
Yeah.
Mike is saying, as a former police officer, Ernest is saying often the show as a former police officer, it's what we are told to do and how we are told to do it, and knowing of that things can change. And the question is, again, do we have the will to really change that behavior? What he said about shields in the trunk and what Ernest said about throwing a net over somebody with a knife. I mean, there are ways for us to do this that we don't have to shoot and kill citizens of the city.
Agreed.
I mean, there are a lot of criminals out here who are well-armed. We know that as well. That's a problem. That's when police have guns. But I mean, it's not an easy question.
It's not an easy question, but it is an easy answer. It's an easy answer that there has to be. There are other ways to quiet disturbances. And if you really think about the intersection of 33rd and Greenmount, every corner is busy. Every corner has a large number of people on it. And anyone shooting at 33rd and Greenmount better be a very, very good shot, because you can just as easily hit an innocent bystander as you could a perpetrator. And we don't know what happened. We don't have all the details. But would that there had been other ways of resolving that situation.
Brandon, before we go back to the phones.
Yeah, I mean, and I stress again, we don't know the details because they haven't been released by the police. The police have the details. But yeah, I mean, that was a concern. And I think I want to stress this, that like the police say they tried to tase him. It didn't take effect. I don't know what that means, but they did that. But yeah, and also from what I heard from eyewitnesses who I talked to quite a few, they fired many times and didn't. Some of those missed. We'll see if that's true or not, but that seemed to be the general consensus. But there was a concern, and people there are yelling, don't shoot. So that's all a concern. And then going back a little bit, one of the other callers said was that, just because I pay attention to the language of the police when I hear the press conferences, there is this immediate support for what happened. Davis praised the officers, and then I remember the specific phrase, which is, you know, by all accounts, preliminarily, they did what they should have done. Like, by all accounts, preliminarily, it's like Orwellian language. Like, it doesn't mean anything. Yeah. So there's that, and I think that ties to it, too, is there does seem to be an immediate knee-jerk on the side of the commissioner to always not only defend the officers, which I would understand, but praise them for their actions before we really know what those actions were. And I think that in some ways emboldens them to keep using force the way they did on Friday, whether that meant...
One of the comments that I heard was that whatever Davis said in terms of defending the police, there was no reference to the individual who'd been shot and you know, this a sense of regret that this had to happen or that this did happen and that might have engendered a more positive response to what the police said and did.
Yeah, absolutely. He's just pure threat. That's how he's sort of presented by the commissioner. I understand a man with who had two knives is a threat, but he's still a man who got shot a couple times or a few times. We don't know how many times.
There's not a whole lot of new news about it, as you were saying, Brandon. 410-319-8888. Trinity, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, there's always alternatives to the shooting, which are never used to their fullest extent.
Pardon me.
It's always taking the easy way out, because as you've been saying, you know they'll get away with it one way or another. But there might be or needs to be a study to deal with the escalation in police shooting of other people and themselves, with the implement of semi-automatic weapons as opposed to revolvers that they used to have. Police are known for shooting themselves in the leg, et cetera, because they don't know how to handle the weapons properly, and the ease of which you can pull the trigger with the Glocks or whichever model that they're brand that they're using. So the semi-automatic, and they're not automatic as people have attempted to throw out, the semi-automatic weapons still make it a lot easier just to fire off a few shots as opposed to you having to think a little bit more.
Right.
You could have a revolver, even though that doesn't give you as many shots. And, of course, that's another thing. You know, you have all these shots, you just throw a few out and waste a few, you know. But that's just one area that might need to be studied, and whether it needs to be quelled or the number of shots or the style of gun changed in order to deal with that, which they probably aren't going to do.
Trinity, thanks so much.
I just wanted to throw that out.
No, I appreciate the call. Thank you so much. I mean, there's a lot to – we have only about a minute left, so –
yeah, just real quick, there was also an officer about a month ago or so that shot himself in the leg. I think it was in Cherry Hill. I'm talking really fast here.
Right.
He basically, and the initial response by the police was an officer had been shot. So that news went out. I went to sleep that night worrying an officer had been shot, which disturbs me greatly. And I woke up finding out much later after the initial story that he had shot himself in the leg with his weapon.
I remember that story as well very well. I want to thank you both for being here. This has been great. You just heard Brandon Soderberg, deputy editor and arts editor for the Baltimore City Paper. Good to have you in the studio, Brandon.
Thank you
so much for coming. And Dana Peterson Moore, community activist, member of the Baltimore City Liquor Board, former chair of the City Ethics Board. Good to have you with us here in the studio.
Thank you very much.
Always a great conversation. Thank you both.
It's wonderful.
On our way out of here, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, has been helping its members and its community prosper for the last 80 years. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Mark Henry. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our research producer is Calvin Perry. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org and the podcast of Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends. Visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.